In the moonlight I felt your heart quiver like a bowstring's pulse. In the moon's pale light you looked at me. Nobody knows your heart. When the sun has gone I see you, beautiful and haunting but cold, like the blade of a knife, so sharp, so sweet. Nobody knows your heart. Hold up your soul, grief and pain.
Happy holidays, ladies, gentlemen, and NBs. Welcome to our third and final Christmas Ghibli on Princess Mononoke. It is I, the subtle doctor, I guess you're Santa for the duration of this podcast, giving you the gift of anime discussion about Hayao Miyazaki, Studio Ghibli, Princess Mononoke, and the eventual end of the world, maybe, unless we can figure shit out. Along with me, ever-present partner for these casts and all casts, honestly, it is the hardest working man in pod business and got the nicest wrench collection I've ever seen. It's Shadon.
Evening, everyone. I'm very, very excited to be covering the Japanese adaptation of Fern Gully, The Last Rainforest.
Man, I don't even know if that's an insult because it's been so fucking long since I've seen Fern Gully.
I feel like it's the one and only thing I should say on this podcast, and I should just walk away into the sunset. My work here is done.
Is that how you feel? Is Fern Gully good?
No.
I don't know.
It has one good thing in it, which is Tim Curry. But Tim Curry's good in everything.
Yeah.
So that's kind of like, yeah, you know, not exactly a perk. That's like saying, oh, you know what? Like, this meal you've served is complete shit, but it's on a gold plate. Doesn't mean you can't put anything else on that plate, you know?
Well, then I'm just going to say that you're wrong about Princess Mononoke. I think it is far better than that.
Oh,
I should have said that anyway.
I know that.
Oh, man.
I'm just getting the hot takes out of the way now.
Right.
Getting them out of my system as early as I possibly can.
Didn't he already do this movie with Nausicaa? Yeah, there's another one. Like,
isn't the message the same? It's so environmental.
Fuck off person that I just summoned into this podcast. You go away and you don't come back. We don't need your kind around here. This is a space in which we praise and gush upon the works of Studio Ghibli, especially this one, Shadon. As we, I think, have done before we've gotten into the nuts and bolts, I'll lay out my cards on the table, my proverbial cards. I love this fucking movie. I've probably seen this movie more than I've seen any other animated thing. I mean, so if I rewatch a TV series a bunch of times, obviously I will have spent more time, more actual hours watching the TV series. But just in terms of number of times I've completed an anime story from beginning to end, this movie is far and away ahead of everything else by a whole heck of a lot, because I've watched it just, I mean, I think maybe 20 times, which is way more than most anime things. Like, I'll be doing good if I watch an anime thing twice, honestly.
Yeah, this is true. Like, I'm going to put on my card similarly on the table here. Now, I know this will surprise you all, because apparently I've had this impression, I think, that people think I might live on the moon or some other celestial body that's not of Earth, given how many anime that I have not seen. I'm still, like, even however many years after we started doing this podcast, a relative novice in this field. But I have seen Mononoke before. I haven't, you know, we've done three Ghibli films now, and I have at least seen one of them that we're covering before we start talking about on the podcast. And it was kind of a... It was a good experience, actually, because I ended up watching it in a club, actually, as a matter of fact. A quick shout out to Fab Cafe in Manchester, which is a frequent haunt of mine on nights out. They actually hosted, for a while at least, I don't know if they still do anymore, but they were hosting nights where they would have, like, I think it was like J-pop discos and stuff like that. And in the earlier part of the evening, they would screen films. So, for example, I think Tekkon Kinrit, that's what it's called, was one of them.
Kinrit.
Yep. That one. Teppanyaki.
I think the comic...
Technodrome.
Right, the comic is... right, yes, Technodrome. That's... why can I not remember the name of the mangaka? It's the same... author that did Ping Pong, the animation, as well as Go-Go Monster, which is one of my all-time favorite manga. The manga that Tekkon Kinrit is based on is called Black and White. It's really, really good, by the way. Y'all should check it out.
Which is why I'm assuming it's in color. Or is it actually in black and white? Oh, no, wait, no. Is it a Peter Molyneux adaptation? No? No? No, really isn't. Okay, so back to this little anecdote of mine. I went to the night in which Mononoke was screening with my dad, actually, and watched it with him. Basically, he just had like this open dance floor over a load of chairs put down on the projector. And it was great. I actually really enjoyed the film, even at the time. This was a couple of years back. I don't think it was before you and I started doing the podcast, but it certainly was, if not before then, like in the very early days of Voridesho. And I really, really enjoyed that, and the atmosphere that was there as well, like this kind of group watching. I'll say ahead of time, like, when this forest spirit first appeared, I think at least three different people started going, Mega Elk!
Oh my god. So this was in a club?
Yeah.
So, like, was clubbing happening around where
no,
it was it just
no,
like...
No, no, That was just in the earlier part.
Kill the humans, save the forest.
No,
it'd be hard to, like, emotionally invest.
No, it wasn't Friends of the Earth by way of Pendulum, I can say that much. But it basically the idea was the whole... It was like a themed, like I say, J-pop kind of night, where they had, you know, Japanese, like, cosplayer... competitions, all sorts of stuff like that, and of course this movie screening. And then once the movie screening, all that was out of the way, that's when they shifted over to doing the clubbing part, where they would start playing music and opening up the dance floor for people. So I didn't stay around for that. It was happening on a work night at the time. But yeah, this is not the first time I've seen Mononoke. This is probably the actual time I've taken real attention to it, though, I would argue, because I mean, there's only so far you can go, like when you're drinking a couple of pints in the middle of an open like club. While people are going around with Mega Elk, which is a great, like, I know with Premiere's recent release, like, there's been a lot of concern about people, like, ruining films by whooping through them when it's not appropriate.
Oh, right, the cheer groups.
But this is that kind of environment where that was encouraged, and that was very enjoyable. So, yeah, this is not the first time I've seen Mononoke, and my opinion of it has only gotten better with a second viewing.
Yes! Dude, I have to say, sticking around for club activities after this movie, that'd be hard. Like, I'm not saying that the movie, like, depresses me. It just, I get very reflective after, and especially after this movie, like, the thought of, recreational drug use after watching this movie does not sit well with me. I would feel weird about it.
I think you have a strange opinion of what clubs are, Doc, generally speaking. Like, yeah, I've been to somewhere, you know, like, they've been lining up the speed and the ketamine and all that. You know, all the flavors of the Class A drug rainbow. But I've also been to clubs where the only drug they serve is alcohol. And, you know, bad pickup lines.
I've only had a police officer explain to me what clubs are, Shadon. It was in the D.A.R.E. program. I know what clubs are. What? I have an accurate picture in my mind.
So by
promise.
By clubs, you of course mean, you know, a sex trafficking dungeon nightmare.
It's exactly how Devilman Crybaby portrayed it.
Where underage kids can sneak in and start fights by smashing... Oh yeah, I suppose that is actually kind of accurate. Oh.
They take drugs and become the devil. Okay. I'm going to steer us back on course by saying... So when did I first see this movie? So I bought this movie on DVD, which I've since upgraded to Blu-ray, but I bought this movie on DVD, Sight Unseen, I think right around the time it came out, like pretty soon after. It was in my local Suncoast Video. Rip Suncoast Video. I miss you terribly.
The sun has set on them. Whoops.
I know. It was many, many people's, like, if not introduction, then, like, that is where the, like, the heat of the love affair with anime took place, was in the Suncoast. They had a big anime section where you could buy it. In the US, and you could just peruse through all kinds of VHS tapes and DVDs, and Yeah, so I saw Princess Mononoke there. It was my 17th birthday. I think I was picking up stuff. And I saw the cover art, and it said, you know, Roger Ebert had a quote on the box that said, the anime Star Wars. And while that's not exactly, I don't think, how I would sort of frame the movie, it was a good enough quote for me to where I was like, okay, I'm checking this out. And I didn't know anything about Ghibli, Miyazaki. You know, I would learn the following year whenever he won the Oscar for Best Animated Film. But yeah, I'm so happy I picked it up, and I have, like, played that disc to the point where, I mean, who knows if it still works, honestly.
You know, can I just backtrack and say, like, when you said that, what was it, Roger Ebert said it was... Was it Ebert, sorry?
It was Roger Ebert, yeah. Yes,
when you said that Ebert said it was, like, the anime version of Star Wars, you do realize now that every time I watch this film from here on out, when Ashitaka, like, and San hold up the head to the Night Stalker, all I'm going to hear is Han Solo's line is, oh, blow this thing, kid, let's go home.
Da, 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 da.
Yeah. That seems ruined now because of my headcanon having no containment, like, or barriers between franchises and such. It's all over.
Gosh, I'm sorry I've done that to you, Shadon. But
that's worse.
But maybe talking a bit about the film in terms of the people behind it. We'll divest the two franchises from one another in your brain, because. As much as I love Star Wars, I don't think Star Wars can hold the candle to this movie in terms of the accolades it has won.
I would agree.
So we've already talked about, like, the principal creatives in other Ghibli casts, so I won't belabor. You know, Hayao Miyazaki wrote and directed the movie. Toshio Suzuki produced it, and the music was by the ever-present Joe Hisaishi. Okay, let me lay this out here for you. You've seen a Ghibli or two.
One or two in my off hours.
Uh-huh. And most of them, I think, have had music by Hisaishi. So, agree or disagree, this is peak Joe Hisaishi. This is him at his best.
Ooh, I'm going to say it's definitely up there, that's for sure. I'd probably need to see more Ghibli to actually, like, make a conclusive answer on that. But he, well... Has he ever done bad work? I don't think he has.
Well, no. This is not at all. I mean, so I don't know if you've seen Nausicaa, but I know you've seen Totoro and Kiki and Kaguya and Laputa,
mm-hmm.
Which are all just amazing. Everything that guy does is great. You know, Spirited Away, great. But this is my absolute favorite. I think his, like, the main melody that he composed for, like, the motif that is present throughout a lot of the movie is so strong and so memorable. Battle, the tracks for the conflict are pretty incredible. The very, like, soft kind of ethereal music that plays during the quieter moments. Moro and Ashitaka are staring kind of across the... That's actually a vocal track, but there are other ones. There's a really fun song when the Kodamas are leading them through the woods.
Yes.
It's very, like, doot-doot-doot-doot-doot, like sort of light rain falling. It reminds me of, like, a scene in Bambi whenever rain is falling on the mushrooms.
It's got that sense of whimsy and wonder that you need for a moment like that to help sell this, like, these spirits to you as the audience. Like, that they're, you know, it perfectly complements their very goofy nature. I mean...
Totally.
I mean, we basically witnessed the birth of the emoji in that scene. That was quite... I'm not hearing you disagree.
Did you really go there? The birth of the emoji. Oh.
And you mean to tell me you couldn't turn the Kodamas into emojis and that they all aren't each a unique emoji?
I think that's where they've all gone now that the forests are gone. They've
what a horrific fate.
They migrated to America Online.
Oh, that's even worse. Jesus Christ.
Into the internet.
Lost in one of millions of unused trial disks.
Ah. Oh, boy. They found their way home through AIM. This was a 1997, I believe it was released in Japan, made its way to the U.S. and other countries in 2001. So the year that it came out, 97, End of Evangelion also came out. End of Evangelion won the Japan Academy Prize for Biggest Public Sensation of the Year.
I was going to say, like, that seems to me like, you know, like, most biggest public sensation. That could work both ways. I'd be careful if you win that award. Just be under no, you know, illusions as to why you've won it.
Well, sensation. Sensation being a positive descriptor. Not like the most notorious or, you know, hated. Anyway, we're not here to talk about EOE. I just think it's interesting they both came out in the same year. Because a lot of people are like, you know, oh, End of Evangelion was this, like, risk-taking movie, unlike, you know, the Ghibli film this year or whatever. And I've seen people make that quote, and I love Evangelion so much. I love EOE so much. I think it's incredible art. This movie, though, I don't know if I'll be able to really convey my feelings for this movie, like, appropriately, because I just think in so many ways it's, like, just this unparalleled work. It's where everyone working on it was at their best.
Yeah. I mean, this is like kind of the middle of the road for us in terms of at least temporarily, in terms of the Ghibli movies that we've covered. We had Laputa, which came about a decade earlier. Then, of course, we had Kaguya, which came about a decade and a bit later. So we're kind of in the middle here. But in a strange sense, like, we have like the bridge between those two works, because obviously Laputa, you know, entirely hand-drawn. There's some CG in Princess Mononoke. It is very limited and only used for specific effects, which we'll discuss when we get to them. And then, of course, we go to Kaguya, which is his own beast entirely. And again, though, I can't stress it as much as you find difficulty in, like, you know, getting across the nuance of this. I myself find it very difficult to stress just how fluid this film looks when it's in motion.
Oh my gosh. It is. Yes. So fluid, and fluidity supported by these really striking details and, like, attention to small things that I think really, I mean, like we've said about other Ghibli films, but, like, just put, like, certain scenes over the top. Just like when Ashitaka in the beginning is, like, running up the watchtower to see the, like, doom marching upon his village in the form of Nago, the boar demon.
Mm-hmm.
The way he's like scrambles up the tower is so smooth and so fluid. I'm just like, wow, all these frames. I'm not used to so many frames. And then like the way he moves, not just that it's fluid, but like the way they make him move and climb is incredible. And then when he's sort of trying to make his elk Yakul run away, like, he can't get his attention by calling down because Yakul is just so stunned that this demon is tromping out of the woods. And he has to fire an arrow into the, like, thick wood pole of the tower.
Mm-hmm.
And just something about, like, the sailing of the arrow and the thunk sound to get him to run. And the fact that he was sort of stunned into, like, he was just paralyzed with fear. Like, I don't know, just something about all that together, like, rolled into a single scene, like, it works for me on such a deep level.
Yeah, and of course then there's this particular scene that I'm about to mention has been shown numerous times on reviews and clips and interviews regarding Princess Mononoke, but I'm of course referring to the one where San attacks Irontown just before the midpoint of the film, and watching her run up to attack Lady Eboshi, like, everything, it's insane. I mean, to give you one idea of, like, just how impressed I was, when she is shot in the head, which, because she's wearing a mask that shatters, like, it would have been so easy for a lesser studio simply to have her obscured in a haze of smoke and not have to animate the painstaking detail in which the mask shatters into, like, two dozen pieces and then knocks her over in the same fluid motion and renders her unconscious. Lesser studios, lesser animators, without such a ridiculously strong work ethic, they'd have gone with that. And being honest, I probably would have been okay with that. But being okay with something is not the same as being enamored with something or, you know, utterly bedazzled by it, as I was with this film. And again, how it feels very kinetic in a lot of parts. And
yeah,
I should stress, which we'll discuss when we get more to the plot, this is probably one of the most disgusting Ghibli films I've personally seen. Now, when I say disgusting, I don't mean as in, like, the actual themes and ideas are awful. But just visually. I'm talking like John Carpenter's The Thing disgusting. Which, by the way, is not the last time I'll be referencing John Carpenter's The Thing. Points to you, listener at home, if you know ahead of time why I'm making that reference. When the gods, for example, start becoming corrupt. Ugh. And that is sold by the, again, the fluidity of the animation of, like, all these proboscis and tentacles and whatnot, and, like, writhing masses that come off them. This, by the way, is the CG element I mentioned. Even then, this is still, it still really, really sells just how grotesque the whole thing is.
You can't spell fluidity without fluid. You get a lot of it in that, and that does transformations. And just to sort of talk about, gosh, we're getting ahead of ourselves. I'm supposed to talk about the accolades the film has won, and instead I talked about End of Evangelion. But I think I love this movie. I love the way that it's able to convey the momentum of bodies, like physical, animals and humans, with like the running and the climbing and the jumping. Like the scene when Ashitaka has, I think, briefly kind of comes to a crossroads mentally when he's been kicked out of the wolf tribe territory and he's being rained on. And then he chooses to go help the women of Irontown, and he's being shot at, and he and Yakul like gallop up to the edge of a lake and jump to a small rock and then jump off that. And then you get full body extension of Yakul to get as far as he can into the ocean. Just something about the way that they animate that momentum. Like it really rings true to like just the inertia and the momentum of the run up and the leaps and the extension. I could just watch it over, just that jump over and over and over again. And that paired with the sound design, just to make it or just a real satisfying thing to look at and behold.
Absolutely.
But okay, really quickly here. So in 1998, cast your mind, if you will, back to the halcyon days of the the late 20th century. So the Japan Academy Film Prize Association is this entity that, of course, awarded film prizes to Japanese movies, as I explained, the most obvious thing ever. But like back then, their attitude toward animated films prior to 98 was like, you know what I mean? Like, these aren't sort of, I guess, similar to what like the American Film Academy's attitude toward animated films is. Like, they have their own category, so they're never going to win the best film award. That's how the Oscars are, and that's how the Japan Academy Film Prize was. They gave like special recognition to, I think, Totoro and Kiki's, and like I said, they made the best film award, or best animated film award rather. But then in 1998, Princess Mononoke won Best Film from the Japanese Academy Film Prize Association.
Wow.
Yeah, it was the first ever animated film to be nominated and to win that prize. And that's just one of many accolades it's won. So it won Best Film and Best Animation Film, and the Japanese Movie Fan's Choice of the 52nd Mainichi Film Awards. Hayao Miyazaki won Best Director, and the film won Yujiro Ishihara, the Yujiro Ishihara Award from the 10th Nikon Sports Film Awards. The Japan Academy Awards, of course, we said gave it the Picture of the Year. The Blue Ribbon Awards, the 40th iteration of that, gave it a special award. The Hōchi Film Awards, the 22nd iteration of that, gave it a special award. And that was in Japan. The the Foreign Film Awards are, I don't think, worth mentioning, although it was nominated for an Annie Award. Hayao Miyazaki was for Outstanding Individual Achievement for Directing. But, of course, Miyazaki wouldn't really break through till his next film in the American Awards stuff. But yeah, it really cleaned up.
would you say this was the point in which Ghibli probably started getting more traction in the Western sphere, so to speak?
Oh, 100%.
Because I think, like, if you look back at Ghibli's works, like, we've obviously covered, like, two of them that are from very different ends of, like, Ghibli's history. This one being the interim one in the middle. But for all that they've been good throughout, there's the thing about good films is that, well, you'll never know they're good if you never see them, and you'll never see them if you never know about them. So it kind of took for a little, like quite a while actually, for at least from my perspective, for Ghibli to gain that kind of traction where they were able to break out of Japan's like orbit, so to speak, and become recognized internationally. Even though they'd been doing great things all along, it wasn't like this was the first thing that was, you know, that was truly noteworthy from them. Of course,
no, it's true. It did take time to build that momentum to where certainly by this point. You know, Mononoke was like, oh, you know, Miyazaki's directing another film. Because I think the last movie he was involved in prior to this, correct me if I'm wrong here, is Whisper of the Heart. I think he was doing some writing on that, but I don't think he directed it. But by that point, you know, 97, 98, like his films, the Ghibli library was becoming more accessible due to anime's sort of international breakthrough as a marketable commodity. And yeah, like Miyazaki was all of a sudden, I think, this sort of darling at like the is it Cannes Film Festival in France?
Cannes Film Festival.
Uh-huh. And at like Toronto and New York, like Mononoke went on this big like film festival deal. Like, and so, yeah, I think this movie's release and kind of the Miyazaki tour and like all the great people that worked on it and people, animation buffs talking about his work for so long, like, and then Mononoke laid the groundwork, I think, for him to win the Oscar with Spirited Away. And everyone is now, you know, by that point saying, like, oh, Miyazaki is this master, you know.
I should add, but I've been restraining myself from saying this, but apparently, according to notes I have from Wikipedia, which I strongly suspect you might have handy as well because of the accolades, but James Cameron cited this film as an influence on Avatar.
That doesn't surprise me at all.
And do you know what's hilarious? We're going to be talking about this a lot later, but I think that Cameron did some great... I'm going to just segue onto Cameron very briefly. Like, he did some great films, like, in the 80s, for example, like Original Terminator, Aliens and such, and Eric Jay and all that. Ridley Scott did it. Look, anyway, point being, Cameron as of late has been shit. And the problem with Cameron as of late is that he has no idea, like, how to do an actual script. And for all that he might cite Princess Mononoke as an influence in Avatar, he seems to have forgotten the core lesson that this film imparts. Because if there's one thing I can say about Avatar is that it was literally like watching a cartoon in every sense of the word, including how the villains were. Just put that in the back of your head, folks, when we get to the point, you know, where we start talking about the themes of this film and the idea of nuance when it comes to the concept of good versus evil.
Indeed. Indeed. I can't wait to talk about that stuff. So I will try to get through this quickly. And like I said, we don't have to talk about, like, how awesome Toshio Suzuki is or, like, the filmography of Miyazaki, because we've done that already. Just go back and listen to the Laputa podcast and the Kaguya podcast. So, Miramax, who you may or may not know, Shadon.
I know of them, yes.
You know of Miramax. They are the folks who helped bring the movie over to Western audiences, to North America in particular, I believe, in the early 2000s. And so, you know, scum of the earth Harvey Weinstein was involved as Miramax is his, you know, studio. And so you have this really fucking weird deal. And I tweeted about this because I was watching a documentary about this movie. And when it, like, premiered in New York, you know, you have Miyazaki getting out of his car and walking into the theater and having to take a picture and shake hands with Harvey Weinstein. It was fucking surreal to see that in 2019.
I hope he washed you afterwards.
Bizarre. Totally bizarre. Another person he shook hands with in that scene, and you may or may not know this, I think I'm going to spring this on you as a surprise. At least I hope I am, because I actually learned this for the first time this week looking into this movie. He shook hands with Neil Gaiman in that scene.
Ooh!
Do you know why?
Because Neil Gaiman was tasked, if I recall correctly, to do the script for this.
He wrote the dub, and he did not admit to it on the record until this year, Gaiman. Because
I remember reading about that, yeah.
Yeah, his name got scrubbed in the way that, you know, people that deserve credit for group projects, you know, often have their name scrubbed. But yeah, Gaiman wrote the script for it. The dub was directed by Jack Fletcher. I need to, before we talk about the plot of this movie, just take a minute here and talk about the dub.
Mm. May I, before we begin, just point out, like, when you said about Neil Gaiman, like, even if I knew very little about Gaiman, I've read some of his stuff, like Neverwhere, for example, I can't think of anyone else offhand, with the possible exception of Terry Pratchett, who I would probably task to handle the adapted scripts of this film, or any Ghibli film for that matter. Because Gaiman has a very good understanding of a kind of magical whimsy, but also, you know, a world in which, you know, there is that kind of thing, but at the same time, a very real danger and threat. Like, where it's wondrous, yes, but it's not tame, so to speak.
Yes, yes.
Gaiman gets that, and so does Pratchett, for that matter. So, very few people would be up to the task of adapting this to begin with. So, kudos, you know, to Miramax for putting him in charge of doing that. Less so for Weinstein being involved.
But, yeah, fuck, well, you, dude.
I mean, you may have missed out the fact that there's also a tale about what happened when Weinstein wanted cuts made to the film.
Oh, no! Dude, please tell the story. I was going to tell the story, but you tell the story.
All right. So, in what I think might have possibly been the most amazing, like, advance call ever of, like, someone's shittiness, after Weinstein, like, you know, said he wanted to get the film edited down a little bit, Miyazaki's staff sent him a katana with a message saying no cuts.
Just to stick it, Noda.
Yeah.
Said no cuts on a katana.
I suppose, like, you know, I would have gone for an alternative, which is only one cut. And I can certainly think of, you know, many reasons that you would have wanted to done that to Weinstein in hindsight. I don't know, maybe I personally, like, I can't translate Japanese. I probably never will be able to. But if I had to ask as a guest, like, if I were looking at that note, I would have probably gone with, do not fuck with. You know?
Yes.
Like,
yes.
That is a statement. That is, like, you know, we've made a thing, and we already know, like, you, well, to be fair, like, Harvey Weinstein having his thumbprints all over things is, you know, a well-known quantity right now. Yeah. So, they probably had some understanding of what a fucking piece of shit he was, even just creatively. And good on them for, like, saying fuck you in a way that's just incredible. Like, the next time, you know, like, my fucking Uber delivery driver pisses me off because he sends my food in cold, I'll tip him with a, you know, a fucking katana or something instead. No ketchup.
That's... a broken bottle. I think a big part of the reason he did that, and I don't know how he feels about Weinstein. Maybe he didn't like him from the go, but I think a large part of why this was a thing was because, have you ever heard of Warriors of the Wind, Shadon?
No.
Okay, so the last kind of big to-do, I think, of bringing over one of his movies for American audiences, and this is back in the day before, like, anime coming over here uncut and untouched was normal. Like, most people that were bringing it over were thinking, like, oh, man, like, this animation is really great, but there's going to be either some stuff that's too violent or some stuff that's too Japanese, you know, for people to get, and it's going to turn people off, so we need to, like, turn these three anime into Robotech to figure to make sure that people watch
God.
It.
I just had like this vision into an alternate timeline where Harmony Gold were responsible for, you know, licensing Ghibli stuff. I threw up a little in my mouth even just trying to comprehend that.
Well, Carl Masek did. I don't know if I think that was part of Streamline Pictures, but Masek was involved with both Streamline Pictures and Harmony Gold. In what capacity for each at what time, I'm less sure about. But he's. He's the man in both of those things that was responsible for, like, he was doing the Robotech surgery and making the Frankenstein monster, and he was doing the Laputa dub. So Warriors of the Wind, I think, also was a Streamline Pictures thing. I've done no research on Warriors of the Wind, but it was the attempt by folks over here to bring over Nausicaa. and it was cut and changed. And again, I don't know all the specifics of the changes because I've never wanted to seek out Warriors of the Wind. Thankfully, when I was an anime fan, like at the time, I became into this stuff. You know, that practice was pretty much dying out, and Nausicaä was available pretty shortly after I became a fan, I think, in its original state. But yeah, Warriors of the Wind was the release of it over here, and it really pained Miyazaki that they cut up his movie, and he really didn't like it at all,
yeah.
The way it's ended up. And so part of the deal for Miramax distributing the movie, like, he was pretty adamant about, like, I don't want you to change anything. And
as it should be.
I think Harvey was all like, what if we just did? And he was like, have
no,
this
he
katana.
Said that many times in his fucking life, the scumbag.
I know. Okay, so the dub. I'll talk about the dub. I want to gush about the dub, but just a brief word about the script itself, because you are so right about Gaiman and the way that he writes. Adapting this was just like, it feels like such a thing in his wheelhouse. And I mean, in that documentary, when he's meeting Miyazaki, you know, he's just gushing and saying like, ah, oh, your form is so beautiful. It's very sweet. But, you know, watching the dub and then watching the subtitled version, I haven't done enough research to know if the G-Kids release of the Blu-ray of Mononoke has like dub titles. I know that was a problem for the Disney releases for a while. The differences between the dub and the sub are very minor, and I love all the changes that Gaiman made. And they're not substantial changes. They're really changes of like just changing the expression to be more precise to English-speaking audiences about a certain feelings the character has or certain intentions.
More naturalistic, yeah.
Yep, mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a really, really good script. And the dub, listen, you guys have heard me talk about dubs before. Nothing makes me cringe like an anime dub. I never watch them for currently airing stuff. I only ever seek out the subbed versions of the original Japanese vocal track. It's what I like. It's what I'm used to. It's what I think is questions of like fidelity aside or whatever, or like this needs to be in its own. Like, I just like the way it sounds. I just think that most dubs, as soon as I hear them, I just go, oh, I just hate the way this sounds. This does not appeal to me at all. Like the acting, and a lot of times the scripts aren't so great. They're just not my thing. I don't enjoy them.
Yeah.
This dub though, Shadon, fucking great. Great.
And that's including the fact, like, this is also, we mentioned in Kaguya, I believe, or possibly Lapter, about how Ghibli seems to attract like a level of voice acting talent that you would not expect for other animated works, certainly not Japanese ones that are adapted over here.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, like, for example, although not one of the films we've covered, in Ponyo there is Liam Neeson.
Mm-hmm.
Actual film actors, like not people strictly known or typically known for voice acting, but instead those known for live action and often quite famous in the West. And I'm reading the list of voice actors and actresses for the English dub of Mononoke, and by God, there is some talent in this. Holy
crap. By God.
Yeah, this feels like they assembled, like, have you ever seen like a cowboy movie where they assemble the group to do a mission?
Yes.
It feels like that. Like, you know, I feel like we should have
seven.
We should have a roll call for them, I think.
Mm-hmm. Totally. That, like, and this is prior to the days where Disney wanted to, you know, is able to plunk down top dollar to get Christian Bale to do Howl. I'm sure Miramax had a ton of money they could throw at these people, but it's the best cast, in my opinion, that's ever been assembled to do an anime dub. Ashitaka is voiced by Billy Crudup. San is voiced by Claire Danes. I'm trying to do this from memory. Jiko, voiced by Billy Bob Thornton. So good. He's really good. And in a little like documentary about the voice actors, you know, the director, Jack Fletcher, just said, like, you know, he's never done it before, but he had no trouble because he's a drummer and it's all about rhythm. Like, he just got into a rhythm and, like, crushed it. Like, did everything in as few takes as humanly possible because he just, it felt, it was just so natural to him to do it, which I thought was interesting. Lady Eboshi, voiced by Minnie Driver. Yeah. Oh, my
Holy
God.
Holy shit.
It is, she is great. Absolutely fantastic in this role. Maro, San's mom, voiced by Gillian Anderson.
Yep.
And look, all right, in a lot of, in all the roles I just talked about, I think while the dub is fantastic, I don't want to like throw any shade, but I'm just going to tell you, I vastly prefer Gillian Anderson as Moro to the Seiyu, in the Japanese version. I just do. And more on that note, do you know who, voices, Okoto?
This is where I get my John Carpenter's The Thing reference in for the second time. Keith motherfucking David.
Hell.
One of my favorite actors / voice actors ever. He's incredible in everything he touches. He could literally be reading out the list of like safety instructions from the back of a tin of paint, and it would be interesting to listen to. I'll list off some stuff Holy that I know shit. Just offhand that this guy's been, that you will know him from, folks. He was in Gargoyles as Goliath, for example. Mm-hmm. He was in The Thing, of course. He was also in Mass Effect as Captain Anderson. He's done a million and one things, and there's not a damn thing that he has touched that he's not been great in.
I mean, again, the Seiyu for Okoto is fine, but give me a better cast for an ancient boar god.
I have one, and that would be James Earl Jones.
I mean, they're playing in the same sport there, so yeah. I will see that. Comparable.
That's it.
Comparable. Maybe not better, but comparable.
Oh, he also voiced the Arbiter in the Halo series, which has just become relevant again.
Yeah,
he's been around a bit, and funnily enough, the Arbiter is the best part of the Halo series. So again, no surprises there.
Oh, did I miss anyone? I'm trying to think. Toki. This is going to maybe sound weird if you haven't heard the dub, but Jada Pinkett Smith does Toki. And she's great. She's fantastic. And has like a real reverence for the material, which I really dig. The cast is great. The script is great. The acting, I just prefer it. I've only seen this movie subbed once, and that was for this podcast. I finally had to break down and watch the Japanese track just because all the other 19 times I've seen this movie, I'm just like, yep, putting on the dub. It's just that good. And, you know, I could see someone arguing like, oh, well, like Crudup is kind of a little monotone for Ashitaka. I disagree, and I don't think Ashitaka is a super emotional guy anyway, high and low. He's not an erratic fellow. And I will definitely see that the Seiyu who plays San, who I don't have in front of me, I think that she does outshine Claire Danes. I could definitely see that one where you prefer the Seiyu, because I think I go that way as well. Not that, again, Claire Danes is bad. I think she does a really good job, but the lady who plays San is excellent. But yeah, I just wanted to shout out that dub, because if you haven't seen it, you should see it. It's excellent. It is excellent. If you, yeah, and you know what? You can give yourself away, I think, the mega elk, right? if you're talking about the mega elk and you only call it the deer god, then you've only seen the sub. The dub only refers to him as the spirit of the forest. never refers to him as the deer god. I love this movie's dub so much.
I mean, if there's anything that we've tried to impress on you here, folks, is just that, like a lot of Ghibli films, like even when the film is complete technically and then it's been, you know, taken elsewhere and given a treatment or a polish to help it appeal to a different audience, it's still being treated with love and respect. And that's what I think, like, is their work ethic in general, apart from being meticulous, of course. Mm-hmm. You can clearly see like where like blood, sweat, and tears went into each part of the film of the films that we've covered, and Mononoke is certainly no exception. There's not part of this film like in terms of its like look, its animation, its music, character design, script, dub, sub, etc. that doesn't feel like, you know, that someone didn't care about it. Like, they definitely, like, poured their heart and soul into it.
Totally. One last thing about the non-plot. Well, I say one last thing. I'll probably sprinkle things in here and there. But this just came to me, hearing your summation. I think a lot of people will mistakenly think that Miyazaki wanted to, like, do Nausicaä over again. Or, like, do a retread of Nausicaä. And so then he came up with this movie, right? But actually, the way he tells it, and you're feel free to disbelieve him, I guess, if you want to. But he actually came up with the idea for both at the same time before either one was actually made into a movie. He was living in L.A. in the 80s, working on this co-production. The doc that I was watching didn't even say what the title was, because maybe it didn't make it to air, maybe it just wasn't worth mentioning, but he was helping with this animated co-pro, and he just disagreed with the producer so strongly that while he was there, he just never put his heart into it. I think he left even before the production was either stopped or complete or whatever, but during the time he was working on it, he would spend all his time thinking about his own ideas, and that's where he came up with the idea for Nausicaä and things like Laputa and Princess Mononoke. So he kind of envisioned them, at least in their initial forms, concurrently. But yeah, okay, are you ready to, like, talk about the movie?
Hell yeah.
Yeah, let's talk about the film.
Let's talk about all the wonderful things this film about. It's like cycles of hatred and, you know, the corruption of the land and, you know, mankind's encroachment on nature and the destruction of life as we know it. All these wonderful things. Let's go!
And yet the movie is not, like, one that will leave you in despair.
This is
true.
At
least that's not what it wants to do.
I agree.
Well, why don't you start us off, buddy? I feel like I've been hogging the mic.
All right, so I'm going to assume that you've seen the film. I'm not going to go into a lengthy plot summary.
No.
Because, again, like with every other Ghibli film we've covered thus far, turn the fucking podcast off and go watch it if you've not seen it already.
Watch this movie!
That's the truth of it. And I'd rather you go in blind rather than having it spoiled for you. But where appropriate, I will give context. And I suppose one thing I want to note right off the bat is just to reiterate a point I made previously about this film is probably the most violent Ghibli film I have seen thus far. And its violence and also the very disgusting and almost like body horror elements to various parts of it, they give it a much, much more visceral feel like than, say, Laputa or Kaguya did. Now, they're not in there, of course, just for the sake of it. They actually serve a purpose. But I can't stress enough like how powerful it is to watch this film and see like the land dying as the gods die out in front of them, like where the corruption spreads from them and the land just turns black and like withers away. The color scheming in this film is fantastic, and it's a particularly noteworthy touch when you look at Iron Town, because Iron Town, despite its name, is not made entirely of iron, it's made of wood, but look at the color grading in all of it. That place is dead. When I say dead, as in, like, you know, the wooden, like, walls of it and fortresses and such like that, they're all coloured in, like, this coal-like grayscale that matches the way the diseased ground looks elsewhere. And it's just, it's stunning to me to look at, like, the rich colour palette of this film and, like, then also just be revulsed by everything I'm seeing on screen. Like, where people's limbs fucking fly off. You can't do that in a Ghibli film. I thought Ghibli films were, like, pleasant and charming and not about mindless violence. And oh, I haven't seen Grave of the Fireflies, by the way.
Well, right. So I'm glad you brought this up. I actually have a thing that I wanted to say about this. If I may steal the mic from you again, after I've just given it to you. So, while Miyazaki was touring, at the various film festivals, in the West, a lot of people had this comment, right? A lot of people asked him the question, like, you know, how did kids take to this movie in Japan? Like, why are you making this movie now? Or this movie sure is not aimed at kids, is it? You know, is this what you're going to do now, make animations for adults? And he had a comment that's not directly related to all those questions, but I think I related it. So when he's in Toronto at like the North American premiere of the movie, he says, he's like, I hope you all enjoy this movie. I made it disregarding all the rules of entertainment. I think there's a lot of things he could mean when he says that, but I think here's some of what he might mean. I think he wants us to, and he said this in a different interview, like, view this movie in the context of the entire Ghibli catalog. Right? You look at most other Ghibli works, as you mentioned. They're aimed to support children, to encourage them, to lift them up.
They're very cozy.
Yeah. Just say, look, you know, you may have some problems, but things are going to be okay. And yes, cozy, comforting. But Miyazaki himself has a healthy respect for the minds of children. In fact, he said that kids more than adults seemed way more comfortable with the fact that there's no clear sort of villain in this movie. That Lady Eboshi is not the bad guy, right? She's not a villainous character. That adults often seem to need clear lines, black and white, white hat, black hat, you know. But kids sort of don't need that. Like, that they know more to reality.
There's more nuance to it, yeah.
Than that, right? And given the reality that they encounter, that the sort of previous Ghibli films alone aren't enough, kids immediately comprehend these really big problems, right, about the world. Like, where are we heading as a species? Like, are human beings doing the right thing for ourselves, for the planet? And Miyazaki said, like, unless Ghibli talks about it directly to them, if we only give them the warm blanket, then we, to them, are going to seem sort of hollow and facile. We're not really facing or addressing their concerns. And he, this was like, blew me away when he said this thing that we had to make this movie or forfeit the right to make more. I was like, wow.
But that is, yeah. You know why? Like, when you put it in context like that, I mean, it's easy for us to now watch this film and look back on it and think to yourself, well, that's another crown, another jewel in the crown of Ghibli, you know. They knocked out of the park again. Are you even surprised? But it is certainly a departure from what we've seen. Also, I mean, just to speak of Laputa, just to keep it in the confines of, like, the films we've covered that came prior to this one. Like, Laputa had its moments of darkness, but it was certainly much more of a rollicking, like, Jules Verne adventure story more than anything else.
Mm-hmm.
As opposed to what this film is, which is, I would almost call it, like, apocalyptic in nature, and yet also about rebirth as well. I certainly do agree that, like, while I obviously don't think, like, you know, wanton violence and such should be in children's material just willy-nilly. I mean, I wouldn't, for example, show, like, Commando or Predator to a kid.
Commando, the greatest anime ever made.
Exactly. Yes, thank you. I'm glad you agree. I wouldn't do that. But I also would, like, show exclusively material aged dependent, of course. I certainly wouldn't show, like, a two-year-old, even, like, some slightly more edgy stuff, if you get my mean.
Mm-hmm.
But I wouldn't also then, like, you know, closet them away from the darker aspects of human nature as shown through things like violence and such, and death in particular. Because one of the more challenging things that children will learn as they grow up is that things do pass on. More often than not, it will be the loss of a family pet, first and foremost. So you can imagine, like, you know, when you see, admittedly, these incredibly vicious wolves and they're dying en masse and all the boars and all that. And you're like, holy shit. And they don't come back. They're gone, you know. They're, allowing a little bit of darkness, though, makes it easier to see the light at the end and to want for a better outcome for our heroes. And having it just be sugar-coated where it's just simply a shouting match rather than the actual war that they're involved in, which is to say the gods, the humans, and the interpersonal, like, conflicts between humans and humans and gods in this. I think that that definitely gives the film its much-needed edge to make the point it wants to make about hatred and institutionalized violence and, you know, like, what we pass on to our children in terms of, like, despising outgroups and, you know, for past sins, quote-unquote, which is certainly something you would want to be privy of, like, when you... knowledgeable of, when you yourself are raising children. So, yeah, I'm very glad that Miyazaki was willing to make that, like, decision to take a chance, basically. Even in a work that fails, I'll always at least admire a creator for trying, mm-hmm. as opposed to playing it safe. So good on him for doing that, and it certainly paid massive dividends with the quality of the work in question once it came out.
Yeah. Yeah, the stakes certainly feel higher than they've ever felt for a Ghibli movie.
Oh, you mean like the end of all life as we know it?
Yeah, pretty much.
Jesus Christ, like, I mean... Okay, it basically is what happens if you just... It just looks like, you know, someone spilled a giant, like, tanker of glue all over the landscape, you know. Or, you know, you could say it's maybe not necessarily, you know, Ghibli's adaptation of Fern Gully, but rather The Blob.
The Blob.
I'm not kidding. Yeah, The Blob. You could say that, certainly, but...
It's a like, you, best you character see the... in Clay Fighter, by the way, The Blob.
Oh, God.
It's a real
but
thing.
But you can, like, see what happens at the end, like, when the land just withers away and just turns into so much dust and, like, death, and then all the people who are swallowed up by it as well, who don't come back, they are gone. And you can infer from that, oh, God, everything everywhere is dead. It's just going to take a little bit of time, but that's the end of it. Holy shit. So, yeah, like, but then, like, that makes the triumph in the end all the sweeter when they finally, you know, return the head back to, you know, the forest spirit.
Yeah, and I don't want to falsely sell the movie as having a happy ending, because I don't necessarily think everyone gets what they want most in the world, but I think, yes, there is a sort of triumph over the apocalypse that all the characters are staring directly into.
Yeah. I wouldn't call it a happy ending, as you say, but what I would call it is a positive ending.
Yep, definitely hopeful.
Which is not quite the same thing, but certainly in the same kind of, like, there's going to be a sense of progress. Like, yeah. Things can change. And I'm going to discuss that in much greater detail when we get to the ending in particular, and how the status quo is set up for the characters after everything resolves.
Yeah, and I think the ending is extremely important.
Oh, yes.
For instance, the fact that San and Ashitaka don't end up together, quote-unquote. You know what I mean? Like, go off and live together as married people in one place or the other. I think having Ashitaka move forward as a person in between Iron Town and the forest actually kind of seals the deal on his character being one of the most relevant anime protagonists that I've ever seen.
He is the peacemaker. One of the peacemakers, the other being San, I would argue, but we'll get to her.
Oh, and he represents, now I don't want to use all my bullets right away, but I think he represents the situation for that we have to deal with as 21st century human beings in a really specific way, in an incredible way.
All right, I'll pass the book over to you, Doc, to continue over the next point, because I've still got plenty more to say, like, about the main conflicts of the film, but I don't want to... I feel like I want to savor that for a little later in the podcast.
Okay. Well, here's a point that I was struck by the last couple times I watched the movie. This is definitely, as you say, an apocalyptic film, and it's not a local tragedy. It's not some kind of local disaster. I think that there's a way to watch it, and I probably watched it a bunch of times, kind of thinking that it was that. Like, oh, it's just for this little part of the world, right? The little stretch of land.
Yeah.
Here.
On the rewatch that I did last week in preparation for this, my impression, like, if I were to, like, you know, assume the horrific, like, you know, bad ending outcome that Ashitaka and San are killed by, you know, the spreading of the Nightcrawler's, like, you know, essence, so to speak, that it would never stop. I did not feel it would just simply come to an end. I figured that would be the end of all life on the Earth as we knew it.
Mm-hmm. And I also don't mean not just the Nightcrawler dying and the goo that's threatening to kill everyone, but I mean everything leading up to that, like all the death, human death, the death of the forest, the old gods dying out, the fact that you have beings that have existed since the dawn of time, but you also have a very real, like, in play scenario where the world could end. It really, like, I don't. It's but so for, I think, fucking I think, awesome because,
yeah,
like,
yeah, I think for like, I think for like the gods, for example, like you when you hear the word god, you perceive it that like as some kind of like omnipotent, like everlasting entity. But even like they are vulnerable in this, vulnerable to gunfire of all things. Now, granted, God in like Judeo-Christian circles means a different thing than it would in Japanese ones, for example.
Totally, totally.
So don't take like the word necessarily to be ubiquitous in terms of like the inferences you can make from it. But nonetheless, you still would think like that they would not go down so easily. But everything and everyone in this film is vulnerable and fragile.
Yes. So this is, it's a very interesting depiction of fragility. Because you would think that if the conditions of the planet were such that things could thrive on it that or live on it that have lived since it began, it must be doing pretty well, right? If these beings that have lived since the dawn of time are still around, then there must be something that's still kind of present from old Earth, some quality of the planet, like that they are still able to live. They haven't all died off, so it must be doing okay. Like just the fact that there's stuff from the beginning meeting stuff that is the end of the world. The world is on like a knife edge. It's so precarious because, you know, the Deer God Forest is this like incredible place that looks untouched by human beings, and yet it lives, but with a little push, a little gust of wind, it could all go away. It could all be destroyed. All the old gods could be done. They're really, as you said, threatened. And again, it's not just in this one like little area. Like, I think the movie has several different lines and scenes to emphasize, like, no, it's the whole world that is going to hell, pretty much, right? Like, for instance, I mean, the opening scene of the movie, Nago showing up in the Amishi village. They are a tribe that is so far away from the rest of civilization, so hidden from everyone. They shouldn't be in the movie.
It's just a regular Wednesday morning, and, you know, he just rocks up hungover, still pissed out of his face. You know, he's rolled around in some, like, you know, ancient evil corruption, and now he's wrecking the place. He's got no domestic responsibility.
I mean,
what
Nago, come on. Come on, dude. Show some...
Clean yourself up. Go to rehab.
Go to rehab.
God damn it. To be fair, I've looked like Moro has, you know, a couple of times after I've woken up on a night out. Whoops. That's what tequila will do to you.
Yeah.
Yikes.
But yeah, so like Nago shows up there, right? And like this far out of the way place that has been able to, for 500 years, hide away from the Emperor, from humanity, is pulled into this conflict because it's spreading its tendrils so far out.
I mean, the message that you, even as far away as you are from the source of the problem, it's still going to affect you and you should probably deal with it. I wonder if that could possibly be relevant in some way to modern times. Nah, I don't buy it.
Yeah.
Not possible. No. But no, joking aside, like, I really should address straight on because the actual issue itself should be addressed straight on. I have to wonder if Miyazaki, like, you know, if he just is in the know, so to speak, like, if he's got a hotline to a higher presence that, like, says, hey, you know what, like, in your own way, you might want to warn people, because this is one of those films that actually has only gotten more relevant with time, thanks to our old, you know, buddy and mine, Captain Planet villain that is climate change.
Yeah.
So, I mean, do I need to bring up, for example, what's been happening with the Amazon, you know, since that fuckwit Bolsonaro got into power? And he decided, you know, like, he, you know, be a lumberjack and he's okay. Wanker. No, I probably don't. You probably know that better than I do. But it's a lesson that's only got more relevant as time has gone on. And as I say, like, for all that, you know, we might think our ecosystem is extremely resilient as, you know, embodied by the gods of Mononoke, they can die. And what I should stress as well, by the way, that I think is really, really crucial to, like, understanding the sense of vulnerability is that, again, if I bring up the idea of killing a god in general, if I said to you could do it just by shooting them, I think that, like, in our collective, like, headcanon of what that term means, and again, I'm probably leaning too into the Western interpretation of it, just hold with me on this. Like, if you were to read into that, you'd probably think, no, that don't make no sense. Like, it's a god. You can't shoot a god dead. Bit daft, that, innit? But no, even, like we don't need anything, like, exceptional or unusual, like, magic or some shit to do awful, awful things to these creatures and to the environment. We only need technology utilized in ignorance or indeed out of spite.
Noting scenes in the movie that, like, emphasize the fact that this is not a local conflict. Like, when Jiko and Ashitaka camp, right, and Billy Bob Thornton has a conversation with Billy Crudup over a steaming bowl of rice, you know, they're camping out, and Jiko's like, hey man, the last time I passed through here, this was a thriving village. There were kids running around. It was green. Everybody's dead now. You know, you're cursed. Your arm is cursed. But guess what? The whole damn world is cursed. And yep. There's angry ghosts all around us. Like, the world is fucked. And the sort of wise old rifleman, Osa, the leper, he says the same thing when talking to Ashitaka. That, you know, he has a disease, but also the world is cursed. But he also says human beings, continue to find the strength to live in a cursed world. And that's where, the movie will definitely end up.
Mm-hmm. If I may make a very brief point, by the way, in how this story is constructed that I think is important.
Yeah.
So oftentimes, like, we're going to talk more in a bit, I presume, about the nuance to which, you know, the characters in this film, like the sides and such and the factions, none of them are evil per se. And I'll get into that in a bit. But what I really want to know ahead of time is that, to my memory, it's not established in the film who fired first, so to speak.
Well, it's now, definitely Iron Town Eboshi showed up. You know what I mean?
But who killed who first? So, like, who shed first blood? Simply turning up to me doesn't feel like it's sufficient, so to speak, to spark off a conflict. Although, well, certainly, it's like...
So, the Iron Town was already there, but... They say, we couldn't get at the iron under the mountain until Lady Eboshi showed up with her guns and fire, and we killed the forest. Like, we chopped down all the trees and burned away the forest to get the iron, and they are the ones who shot Nago. You know, that's how he turned into a demon. I think that it might not have been just one battle. It might have been several over time, but Eboshi fired on the boars first.
Right, okay. Because I was under the impression that it wasn't made it very, like, entirely explicit who shot first. Because the point I was going to make was that...
I think it doesn't matter as much to...
No, that's exactly... Yeah. Well, that's it, though. Like, it not being mentioned. Like, you would think in a lot of stories it would be crucial that you make that very, very explicit. What was the inciting incident? What was that specific moment in time? But the thing that I really admire about Mononoke's examination of this conflict is that doesn't fucking matter who fired first. You're just doing it now. It's just happening. There are reasons that they have, but the reasons are built on top of, like, counter reasons, like,
totally.
And responses and rebuttals. How many conflicts can you and I name in real life, Doc, that feel like or actually have been going on for centuries to modern day based on ancient, like, you know, grievances?
Yeah.
I'm not going to name any in specific so as not to devolve this into being all that political, but I mean to say, like,
no politics and animation on.
No. What was I thinking?
How dare you?
God. But I mean to say, like, you know, the point of the film, amongst others, is that, you know, just stop. Like, it doesn't matter. Like, the conflicts, like, in itself is the reason. Like, it's a self-perpetuating thing. It is the reason for its own existence now, rather than anything that we, like, living, like, you know, modern-day people have to deal with. Or, like, you know, are still slighted by, like, it's our ancestors. And I'm not saying, you know, you just give up your grievances necessarily, but, like, you might want to start working towards de-escalating them rather than just perpetuating them on and on and on, to pour water onto the fire rather than petrol.
And you might be like, ah, Eboshi, you know, they showed up and tried to take the home of the forest gods, and they, you know, she fired at Nago and turned him into a demon, and that's what set it off, and she's the ultimate villain. And the bad one, and is starting the bad and the bad things. But, like, A, see everything that you said. B, she's trying to carve out a home for a group of people that the world has rejected and treats as garbage, like lepers and also brothel workers. Like, she wants to make a safe haven for these men and women, and needs, unfortunately, the world we live in, she needs money and goods to barter, and so she feels like she has to have this iron to do it. And she has good reasons for doing what she's doing.
Yeah, indeed, also to make the weapons with which she defends herself, because Maboshi's not only fighting the gods, she's fighting, like, the samurai as well.
Yes, yep.
And the samurai's reasons for fighting her are even less well-developed than the ones I mentioned previously, which, again, only goes to serve the point. By the way, the gods are also in on this, because they themselves have their own tribal lines that only seem like they exist because that's how it's always been. That they've always had this kind of conflict going on, or this pecking order, and with things being shaken up a little bit, like, for example, the ape tribe getting on it, they now feel they have, like, the, you know, position and the strength to start saying to those, hey, you know, that kid there? That kid right there? Yeah? Looks like a chicken nugget to me. I reckon I'll take a bite out of that. You know?
Scrumptious.
Anyone got... I mean, you know what, like... I'm really glad, at least, you know, that the apes from Stanley Kubrick's 2001 got to look after they, you know, did their inaugural thing with the monolith and throwing the bone around. Good for them. Good for them, I say.
Oh, man.
All right. So, yeah, you're right. And this is probably a good time today for me to address, because I'm going to be honest, I do have some issues with the film. Not major ones. Don't. You know, please don't, like, you know, tie me up and throw me into the ocean, like, you know, with a pair of concrete shoes. Don't do that just yet.
Toki will pour boiling oil on you, like she did the samurai.
well, at least I'll be exfoliated. I'll have clear skin for days. So, I do have, as I say, some mild complaints, quote-unquote, I suppose. Let's just call them observations at the moment, and I'll let you all be the judge after the fact about this film. I wouldn't take them, like, as me, like, hating on the film. But I'm just going to get this first one out there, that you and I have actually discussed off cast, Doc, and I'm going to offer this more as a point of discussion. So here's the thing, right? I've talked about nuance when it comes to the idea of good versus evil in this film, because if I just to restate something that I think you may not know as part of writing 101, characters are never evil simply because, unless you're literally writing Satan. But even then, Satan, like, you know, was jealous of God's, like, power and all that. So even in something like that, which, you know, you point to saying he's, like, the embodiment of all evil, well, he has a logic and a reason behind it. And that applies to a lot of, like, villains, if you really do think about it. They're doing what they think is right. It's just that, you know, our modern consensus of, like, morals and ethics suggests, you know, hey, maybe don't fucking do that. That's the first point, in that no one is what I would call, like, surface-level evil in this film. Not even necessarily the monk, Jago, although he himself is Jigo, although he himself is a bit of a prick, let's be honest.
A little bit.
I mean, you know, do you want to give the head back so we can, like, prevent the end of the world? Nah. Nah.
The sun's almost up. We're golden. Come on.
No refunds, bitch.
The emperor.
I know, that was totally a line from the dub, by the way, even though I haven't seen the dub. Here's the thing about Eboshi. Like, you yourself said that she's carving out a home for these outcast people, the marginalized, you know, such as the lepers and the brothel workers. Now, my reading of this film initially was that in some way you could have taken the lepers as a kind of, you know, indictment against nature because of how cruel and unjust it can be to certain people, how unfair it can be. I mean, I don't know if you know, but leprosy is fucking horrific. I mean,
yeah.
this ain't no eczema shit that you can clear up by going to the body shop and buying yourself a nice facial cream that's scented with fucking lavender. You know, it's the wretchedest shit. And that, to me, like, gels with the fact that, like, Eboshi might have a little bit more venom inside of her regarding fighting back against the forces of nature as represented by the gods, because she is caring for people whom nature has been very unjustly cruel to for basically no reason. So I like that. I like the fact that the lepers are in there for that reason.
Just to compliment what you're saying, like, the brothel worker ladies are people that humans have been incredibly unfair and unjust to. And I have to think that, like, her kind of crusade in that area is just speculation on my part, but that comes from some kind of trauma she herself has suffered.
Maybe she herself was one in the past.
Yeah,
you can say.
Right? And so she has grudges against everyone, nature and human. But no, sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you. I just wanted to...
Well, no, your interruption was actually quite pertinent there, because that was the point I was going to make next, which is that I can't help but wonder how to feel about the element of the brothel workers being there. Not because the brothel workers, by the way. I hope that's been clear from all the stuff that I've covered over, like, the
years. What you got against brothel workers, Shadon?
The fact that they don't call me back. Anyway.
Come on, Toki. Divorce. What's his name? Why can I not remember his name?
Are you about to quote... No, you can fuck off mentioning that show if that's what you're about to mention.
No. Princess Mononoke, the Jada Pinkett Smith voiced, kind of the main lady in the pink kimono.
Oh, yeah. The one who's constantly beating up on her husband.
Yes,
you're right. But here's the thing, right? I'm of two minds of this, because on the one hand, I do agree with you that, you know, it might be a bit too simplistic that if that wasn't there, because then it points out that the humans are just as bad as well. Because believe it or not, like, my opinion on sex work is legalize the fuck out of it, and the bad shit that happens that is associated with it are all problems of, like, our own creation, like, you know, pimps, abuse, violence, police violence, blah, 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 blah. And certainly we get the impression in the film itself that the brothel workers that Eboshi has released and saved, they were subject to such a system where they were abused and exploited by, you know, pimps and such, and an unfair social system. So on the one hand, I appreciate that it diversifies Eboshi's, like, viewpoint so that, you know, it's not just her hating on the forces of nature, but also that people of her own species and her own kind are also fighting against her, and she's fighting back against them for the evils that we inflict on each other. That's good. But then I also do think to myself that it kind of undercuts her, like, feeling a little bit of how she, like, is fighting back against the forces of nature when one of the stated reasons that she's trying to carve out Iron Town as a safe space is the fault of other humans, as opposed to, say, something else. I've had a fondness, because you and I discussed this off cast, actually, after I finished watching it. And I'm going to go with your side of it, which is to say that I think it's fine the way it is. But I do wonder, like, you know, if perhaps maybe, as I'm often very fond of saying, maybe that could have been addressed as a point in which one of the characters would bring up. Maybe Ashitaka himself would be like, you know, we're only making more problems for ourselves by doing this. You're solving a problem that humanity has created. And maybe we should, like, try and figure out how to stop that to begin with, rather than just, you know, continually putting our own fires out. Maybe it's something that I feel could have been expanded on a little bit to give it more bite, I think. It certainly works fine as it does right now, don't get me wrong.
Yeah, that might have taken the spotlight away from the, you know, humans versus nature, like the central kind of conflict undergirding the big battle and everything. So, and yeah, I don't know that it matters all that much. I mean, maybe it does adding to, like, the nuance of Eboshi's character and making her not villainous, you know, but, like, she's trying to solve a human problem by, like, fucking over the forests and animals, and they are entities that deserve dignity and respect also. At the end of the movie, I think she sees, like, okay, we're going to start all over and do something better here. She realizes after she was saved by San that, hey, we need to build a place that doesn't exploit nature or people.
I think from what you're saying there, Doc, like, I think that something that we should really take away is that while I did describe the way Irontown looks before as incredibly bleak and, like, industrial, like, even in the organic materials that are used there, such as the wood, looking like they're still, like, forged from metal, like, being very cold and grayscale, the idea of Irontown is a noble one. It's just not been executed entirely perfectly, shall we say.
Thanks, Jigo.
Yeah, thanks a fucking bunch, you prick.
In bed with Lord Asano and the samurai.
The fucking samurai. So yeah, I only bring that up just because I think to myself, like, you know, It's fine as is, but I wonder if it could have been sharpened up a little bit. And I suppose that for the sake of getting it out of the way, so that way I can then, and these other two complaints I have, I'll get these out of the way now so then I can spend the rest of it gushing about the film, because okay, there's so much bits to love. I think the film has a bit of a pacing problem. Now, when I say that, I found it difficult at times when I was watching the film to try and get a grasp of what Ashitaka's objective was. Now, you might say, well, his objective was to find Lady Eboshi, but my answer to that is then, to do what? Like, they're still fighting. Like, it's not, like, what is his end game here in finding
At what
her?
Point in the movie?
I think that was around, like, the time in which, God, I'm trying to even place it. I'm finding difficulty, like, in, I think it's after the point in which he separates from San and goes back to Irontown briefly and tries to find her.
Oh, right. So why is he looking for her?
Specifically, yeah.
Because he wants to tell her, hey, Irontown is being, it's under siege by the samurai. You need to go back and protect your women and not worry about killing the deer god.
Hmm. I suppose.
So that's when he runs into her in the forest and he hops off the wolf, and that's what he tells her. And she tells him, like, oh, so you want me to spare the deer god but kill the samurai? And he's like, I want everyone to live together and work this shit out in harmony, actually.
Yeah, it feels like he's doing, I suppose, too much firefighting rather than... That, I think, is the way I would describe it. And maybe, indeed, that's the point, that he only can, you know, do so much as a single individual. You know, certainly difficult for groups of people to try and change other people's ideas. And he does in the end. Mm-hmm. But I think for me, like, I felt at times like I didn't have quite a firm grasp on what the end game was here. Like, it felt like he was flying very by the seat of his pants. And I'm not talking in terms of, like... Well, not so much like as intended by the story, but rather that what's going, like, what is exactly is the end goal here? What exactly are we trying to do and accomplish? Now, that is just entirely my feeling, I should stress. And it only, like, reared its head for moments at a time, like, throughout the midpoint.
All I can say is hard disagree.
Because
I love the way the movie's paced. Like, again, I find it to be, like, the most watchable of movies.
Mm. Well, maybe pacing is the wrong word, so it's just more just having a sense of, like, what the current, like, what everyone wants at the moment.
Mm. Okay.
And again, maybe the point is the fact that no one knows what they want because they're all just too stuck up their own asses to, like, you know, realize maybe we shouldn't be fighting each other anymore for over pointless shit. Maybe that is the point.
Ashitaka, I think, is the one, and maybe San at times. Like, Ashitaka, I think, after he gets kicked out of the wolf tribe cave... And kind of has, like I mentioned earlier, a little bit of a crossroads where it's a great scene, by the way, where he's wandering through and a storm kind of quickly comes on him and it's raining and it's very gray and he's kind of looking down while slowly riding Yakul. And then he looks up and he sees this point where at the top of the hill, a storm is broken. It's sunny. It's clear. If you go to the top of the hill, you could see. And then I think he remembers what he told Lady Eboshi and what the elder of his village told him. He's here to see with eyes unclouded. He could be upset at both groups, but that doesn't mean that he should not empathize with and try his best to save as much as possible both groups. Because then immediately he hears an explosion and thinks... It's San, but sees it's Irontown. And we know at that point in the film, he's very sort of opposed to the ideals of Eboshi, but he goes to Irontown anyway because there's people there that need saving.
Yeah. You're definitely not wrong here, Doc, about everything you're saying. I can only really speak to how I felt. And
sure.
I will just point out as well again, folks, like I'm no definitive authority on, well, anything really, except for Old Spice. Like, I love rubbing that shit into my fucking scalp. But anyway, no, product placement in
you
this podcast
Terry Crews
aside. Oh, he's a good lad. Product placement in this podcast aside, the point for me is, like, the final point I'll make is one that, again, I have discussed with you off cast.
Okay.
And funnily enough, there's actually evidence of this being a thing that Ghibli themselves were aware of, which I've read on the Wikipedia page for Mononoke. So, here's the thing. This film is called Princess Mononoke. But for me, it's not really so much about her as I would expect. I mean, you and I actually had this very discussion, believe it or not, when we were discussing Princess Kaguya, how it made more sense for it to be called The Tale of Princess Kaguya as opposed to the Woodcutter. Whereas we have the opposite issue here, where my feeling is that it probably should be called The Tale of Prince Ashikata. And would you believe it? They actually had a discussion about that in Studio Ghibli, about naming it one way or the other. I'm going to actually find it here. Yeah, it says here, it was ultimately chosen and translated as Princess Mononoke. Miyazaki had actually preferred Legend of Ashitaka as the title. But in the end, they went with Princess Mononoke. Because Ashitaka, like, is the audience character, like, proxy character in many ways. Like, he serves as, you know, classic case of, hey, I'm leaving my village, I'm going to go elsewhere. And he fulfills that very efficient narrative function of being someone who doesn't know about the wider world. So when things are explained to him, we learn about them as well. Mm-hmm. That kind of like very classical organic storytelling. Now, that in of itself doesn't mean that he needs to be the focus of the film, but he's certainly the one who's got the most agency in it, in my opinion. And he's the one who actually contributes to solving the problem in the end, which, by the way, if you think about it, is actually very, very chilling, because it takes an outside force to stop this conflict from happening. Mm-hmm. Does that not actually scare you a little bit? That there's no like internal agent like that actually breaks out of the cycle, and it takes an outside event or person to solve it. That's actually That's actually quite grim when you think about it. And I feel bad for bringing that up. Fuck.
Well,
But anyway, so my issue is that I felt like San for a lot of the film. And this was like something I felt even when I watched it in that group watch and then I mentioned before in the club. And I felt it again, although to a lesser extent. I felt like she had not enough to do, so to speak. The thing I think I've realised about it is that she, while she is very explicitly through being a human, like a bridge, much as Ashitaka is a bridge in his own right, she leans too far into the nature side of things to feel truly distinct from the wolves and have, like, you know, a conflict of perspective with them. That does change throughout the film, of course. But throughout much of it, like, I think she either gets knocked out or she's, like, taken out of fights or she is just fighting. She doesn't have an end goal in mind to change the conflict until Ashitaka, like, gives it to her. Now, am I complaining, like, oh, the man came in and gave the woman a position on life? No, I'm not doing that. I'm not even going... I mean, I've said some stupid shit in my time on this podcast, but even I'm not that dumb to make that point. But nonetheless, again, this feels more like a sentiment rather than something I can, like, objectively point to. Like, oh, I mean, I'm certainly not going to go so far as say, well, in this particular film, that she had about 20 minutes of affirmative action, whereas Ashitaka actually had 50. Now, does that seem a bit imbalanced to you based on the name of this film? I tell you, I made this pie chart. And also, my accent was changing suddenly all the way through.
Say thank you, like, early 20th century politician of some sort.
I wish we could go back to that right now, but that's a different discussion for a different time. Anyway, so yeah, this just again feels like a kind of feeling to me that it doesn't feel like her film so much. Now, I'll grant you, she is certainly the most recognizable character from the film. Like, if I show people pictures of characters from the film and said, which one do you recognize the most? They point to her immediately. Hell, of all the Ghibli films I've seen, I think obviously for many reasons, but certainly just because of visual appeal, I've seen Mononoke cosplayed the most, as in the character. Mm-hmm. But yeah, again, I can only speak to this kind of sentiment or sense of ennui that I thought, it's called Princess Mononoke, but it doesn't necessarily feel it's entirely about her or about her sufficiently.
Well, she's not the main perspective that we see the world through, as you say. But she is an extremely important character with important implications for the entire world, and makes a lot of just... In fact, I think she's with Ashitaka a very little amount of the movie. Like, I think a lot of times she's doing her own thing with her family. I mean, I don't necessarily think she needs a different point of view from Moro and the Wolves, because they're her family. And she does, of course, go with Ashitaka toward the end of the movie. So she kind of, but she's kind of, but her mother Moro still is in favor of that by the end of the movie. She kind of brings them together in a way. So I mean, but you know, for all that, like, I think I don't think this is like a super invalid complaint or anything. I definitely see your side of it. And I do think it's interesting that, you know, Ghibli as well thought, maybe we should not call the movie.
I mean, I'll be fair here. I'll be very blunt. Holding like a film to the wall and nailing it to said wall over a name, over its name and the like expectations you get from that, that's really small potatoes in the grand scheme of things.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly, you know, she's a badass through and through, and she has her own fantastic moments throughout the film. And as you say, the ending, which is such a key moment for me, like she is fundamentally part, indeed she dictates the terms of it, which I think is very, very important. And shows like how she has changed throughout the film. So yeah, just again, take this as me like being grouchy over a feeling I had rather than anything I can necessarily point to and go, well, you know what? His mouth was animated at a 90 degree angle and therefore it looks stupid. It's not something like that.
Oh my. Well,
anyway, that's my complaints about the film out of the way. And now the rest of it is just going to be me gushing everywhere.
Well, do you want to talk about Ashitaka or do you want to talk about Lady Eboshi?
To be honest, I don't think we can really discuss them separately if you follow.
I see. Well, I guess I have different sort of points for each one that are separate. But I do take your meaning, though. I definitely see where you're going with that.
In that case, I would say lay it on me some. What points you got?
Well, for which should we go?
You can pick.
Okay. All right. Well, let's talk about Ashitaka then. I love this man. I love this man.
Is he your husbando?
He is not in that way. I would say like...
I'm kidding.
Well, listen, there are characters I would say you're my husbando, but he's like my hero. He's like, I deeply admire him as a character. I had one of those things in high school, late high school, because like I said, I saw this movie first when I was 17. And late high school, we were doing, I don't know if it was a survey or what, but it's like, who are your heroes? And among them, I put Ashitaka, because I felt that strongly even then and still feel that strongly today. There's so many, there's big things and there's little things, Shadon. Like, it's a small thing, but when the battle is ongoing toward the end of the movie and Ashitaka and San are separated and he needs to get to her, and he leaves Yakul with the men from Irontown and starts off with one of her brothers, one of the wolves. He doesn't jump on his back immediately. He, out of respect for this wolf god, he's like, doesn't assume he's going to get a ride. He starts to run, and he runs on his own until the wolf god says,
"Yeah,
hey, man, you're slowing me down. Jump on, and we'll be faster this way."
I mean, come on, I'm your Uber driver and all that.
Like, the fact that he doesn't ever leave Yakul. Like, Yakul stayed with him when his gunshot wound was being healed, but then when...
Oh, come on, that was his Stasi Pokemon. Of course he's not going to get rid of that.
Well, think about it, right? He got shot by an arrow,
I'm kidding. Yeah, I know.
And he couldn't ride him anymore. How many characters would have just been like, well, noble steed, you fought well, but peace, I'm out. I've got shit to do. No, he took him and led him by the reins all the way to his destination, the Men of Iron.
Can I just add, by the way, I, in the initial watch of this, thought, that elk is fucking dead. I really thought they were going to do it, but they didn't. And I'm so glad they didn't because you're right. Yakul is awesome.
Yakul is cool. And of course, there's like the badassery that he gets to do. Sort of, I have a lot more kind of upstanding noble points about it, like sort of moral points about him and everything, but look, he catches a fucking arrow that shot at him and then turns around and shoots it at a guy and decapitates him with it. It's a badass, man.
I think you dropped this fucking baller. do you want this back?
Oh my god.
I mean that's the you know, nature centric nature positive attitude of this film. It's recycling.
Oh, and I know that, like, having him be like have superpowers because of the curse doesn't necessarily like tightly jibe with the sort of message of like the mark is the hatred that infests all men and shit.
But like, I actually think there is a message behind that, believe it or not.
But it's just cool. that he gets to do shit.
Don't get me wrong, it is. So here's the thing, right? It is hate that he is infected with. That's basically what the curse is, mm-hmm. the curse of rage. Emotions, like even positive ones, can be used to awful ends. Like you can love someone so much that you might never want to let them leave your house, for example. But I think that in turn, like, you know, being angry, being hateful of something, I know that it might sound strange, but I think that you can use that to a good end. So we see Ashitaka, like, you know, restraining, like, this curse that's on him, this hatred, mm-hmm. at various times throughout the film when it is appropriate for him to do so. But then he utilizes it to accomplish his goals as well, like when he's being attacked, to save his own life. It's, I think the different distinction here is that he manages and controls that hatred and masters it for his own use, rather than the, not strictly speaking, curse variety, but the regular kind of hatred everyone else feels towards each other,
right.
which blinds them.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't say, you know, we should never get angry or annoyed or upset with people.
Right.
But rather that we have to channel it to a positive and a goal in the end. Granted, that means, you know, shooting some motherfucker's head off in a drive-by on your magical elk. But nonetheless, like, it's something he still utilizes to get what needs to be done. Indeed, isn't there a scene like where he pushes a boulder or moves one of the wolves around with it? Like, he performs acts of physical labor.
The gate that, yeah, like, gate. For Irontown that they say, listen, stranger, don't be a fool. It takes 10 men to open this gate. And he's like, I came in through this gate this morning. I'm going to leave through this gate right now.
Yeah. God, like, damn. That's it. Yeah, he utilizes it for his own ends. Like, it doesn't, like, control him. He masters it and he uses it to do what's necessary. So I think that that's the message behind that. And that in turn, like, is why I say that this is relevant to the rest of the characters, because their hate has taken control of them. They're no longer in the driving seat. They're just blinded by it. They're just fulfilling base emotional desire of perpetuating it.
Yeah.
Succumbing to it. Whereas he masters it.
It's a good point. No, that's totally fair. And kind of in the same vein of the smaller things I was talking about a moment ago, though, like, you know, a character consumed by hate, we see right at the beginning of the movie, Nago. When he's, like, barreling toward the Amishi village, Ashitaka doesn't kill him immediately. He's not out there throwing lethal strike. Like, he pleads with him. He asks him, like, you know, calm your fear, mighty lord. Like, you know, we are just simple people. Like, please, like, don't destroy. Like, very much trying to reason with this guy while still holding him in the esteem that his godlike position merits. Despite the fact that he's clearly a threat, and he does not start firing arrows until his sister Kaya is under threat. And then he has no choice, and then he turns to that. And so just like things like that, where I'm just like thinking to myself as I watch this movie for the umpteenth time, hey, anime creators, can you please look at Prince Ashitaka maybe as some sort of a template? Because anime makes a lot of assholes.
I would like that myself. Believe me, I've covered a fair few shows now where a gentleman, you know, in a show gets a magical power on his right hand. And boy, oh boy, like, you know, for all that, like, I could argue, oh, it's lame that all he gets is super strength out of it. And, you know, he looks like he's got sea urchins on his arm occasionally. You know, he's a far more nuanced and interesting character than the assholes who I've covered in shit like, well, fucking Guilty Crown, I suppose, where they have these wondrous and, like, really cool powers and all that. And, you know, it's like giving the BFG 9000 to, like, fucking, like, Tom Green. Why the fuck would you do that? Why would you give something so cool to a complete shithead? I'm just saying.
I haven't thought about Tom Green in a while.
I'm bringing it back for you. I'm so sorry.
Man. But no, the Amishi prince is, like, thoughtful and quiet and kind and honest and strong. Like, he's just such a good person. And I would like to see anime about good people more often. Not that you have to every time. I mean, my goodness, we've talked about how much we enjoy villains and flawed characters and all this. But, God, it just feels like so many protagonists in modern anime are just assholes. But I think, so the larger reasons that I like Ashitaka, going back to the end of the movie, when he and San do not get together.
Oh, this is the big moment. Man, do I have some feelings on this. Good feelings.
Yeah. And San says, I love you, but I can't be with you because I still have so much hate toward human beings for everything that they have done. And he gets it. He doesn't try to change her mind right then, and he doesn't try to change her mind at all. And it's just like, I understand. So I'll visit you in the forest. You and the wolves live there. And I'll live with humans in Irontown, and I'll try to rebuild. Miyazaki said that going forward, he feels like Ashitaka will be torn apart but between his love for San and his duty to support Irontown. So between love and duty, these opposite forces pulling him apart. But that won't stop him living the way he wants to live, because he treasures both so deeply. And I think this is why his approach to life has meaning for us living in the world today, because our world is obviously not the world of the gods and the pure green natural beauty untouched. That's not where we live. But that is still part of our world. That's still around us. That is still part of reality that we're deeply dependent on. And we have to live in Irontown, and we have to live with the forest, and sort of metaphorically speaking, right? And we have to help bridge the two, and we have to be sources of empathy for people on both sides to help heal so that we're not torn apart, and so that the planet is not torn apart.
All right, so for me to, I suppose, since we talk about the ending, let me talk about why I really, really fucking love this ending. Here's the thing, right? It's all well and good to have a story that ends with everyone riding off into the sunset and everything's happy. But the thing about hatred is, as San herself says, she's not, like, purged herself of it entirely. Maybe that would happen over time. We don't know. I'll leave that to the fanficers to, figure out. But the point is that hatred and new conflicts can arise at any given time. So I actually really like the relationship that she and Ashitaka, have, this working relationship, if you will, where they remain in a kind of state of tension towards each other. Her, being nature, him being, humankind. As a kind of thing that they always have to be conscious of and cultivate and work towards developing, rather than lapsing over time and letting it just fall by the wayside because they forget. They don't simply settle down with each other and let that be that. They, as I say, have that tension, that ongoing re-examination, where they'll continue to catch up without ever getting too close to the point where they become too comfortable with each other. And I really, really think that's a stunningly mature way to end the film with the message that it's not a one and done thing to simply save the forest spirit and all life on Earth. This could happen again.
Yeah.
There could be conflicts that continue on. Indeed, the samurai conflict with Eboshi is certainly not over. And, the conflict between the forces of nature and humanity could very well come back to the fore again if someone violates territory or, and sparks it off again as they did previously. It doesn't say that, we're one and done when we've done a good thing. We have to keep doing it. We have to keep being conscious of our relationship to nature and nature vice versa. And we have to, always be aware of that and not, let ourselves fall into old habits, old ways, and dare I say, old, grudges. It's so mature.
Yeah.
I fucking love how that happens, because it to me speaks to that aspect of humanity that I find is often something that people mock, but is actually a source of strength, which is it's not that, we never make mistakes. We never, have moments of weakness. And when I say weakness, I don't mean in terms of being upset. I mean where we give in to temptations to do something awful. But rather that when we have these moments of weakness, we have the power to recognize them for what they are and then stop them dead in their tracks. It's not, a case of we're going to end up flawless individuals who never think awful things. but rather that we may well think these awful things, but we will never put them into practice. We will quell them and silence them each and every time they come up, because that's human nature.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's fucking incredible. It's such a great ending for the film that in itself has been very mature and very nuanced in how it portrays like both sides, the gods and, you know, Eboshi and Irontown, as having their reasons that, while understandable, are also like irrelevant versus the, you know, destruction that they're wreaking on each other, to then follow through by not having a fairy tale ending, so to speak. Good shit, Miyazaki. Good fucking shit.
Yeah. Yeah, it's, you know, fitting that Eboshi and the Irontown folks are gonna build a town, because that's almost like a metaphor for, you know, what is being asked of everyone at the end as well, like internally and relationship-wise. You know, just getting one thing right? Like, just laying one stone, you're not done. You have to build the thing. Like, a foundation is just a foundation, but it could be swept away. Like you said, it could be destroyed as easily as you built it. You have to work at it. You have to build it up over time. You have to defend it. Yeah, man, that's really good.
If I may just say, like, I wouldn't want to see this necessarily, because I think the film is perfectly fine.
No, don't say it.
Capturing itself.
Princess Mononoke 2.
No. Hear me out, though, because that would play into the very idea I've just mentioned, that it would, you know, that new conflicts can arise and we have to be vigilant about those. Now, I'm of the opinion that we don't want that, because I think that would also then kind of, you know, dilute the message that we can overcome it. Like, oh, it happened again? Oh, fuck. Yeah. Really? Really? You gone done that shit? You gone done burn the forest down? Nice one, douchebag. But that's why I think that I'm more open to that idea than I would be with, say, a Labyrinth sequel, for example, or any other Ghibli sequel, just because I think that it would play into that idea that, you know, it could go wrong again, but then we can in turn overcome it again. So, but yeah, that revelation I had, I didn't realize at the time I was watching it in Fab Cafe, probably because I was on my third pint at that point. I don't tend to drink while I'm actually watching. No, there was no J-pop on just yet. So I now have a much stronger appreciation for this film for the fact that it's not willing to give the easy answer at the end.
Mm-hmm.
There's nothing easy about any of the situations in this film, with the possible exception of give the fucking head back to the god of death, you moron. Like, that to me seems pretty cut and dry. Like, oh, I'm going to get money from the emperor. Guess what? Money ain't worth shit if everyone's dead. You know? Check out my pile of gold. Oh, also, I died for it. Well done.
Oh my gosh. This will take us into Lady Eboshi stuff. I think Ashitaka serves us really well as a model for moral decision making. And I'm going to be borrowing liberally from Ian Danskin of Innuendo Studios here. He did a tremendous video on called Lady Eboshi is Wrong. And I'm sure we're going to link it in the show notes, but because it's not on YouTube anymore. No idea why. I'm sure it's a copyright issue. Or maybe people were being assholes in the comments. Who could say? But it's still on the internet. If you Google it, you can find it. But I'm going to be borrowing about this point and then some of the Lady Eboshi stuff, because I think he dissects all of that incredibly well. But Ashitaka is a moral decision-making model, right? Like, so he's meant to go into the world with eyes unclouded, which is a way of saying...
So sober.
So, right, uh-huh, yeah, no ecstasy. And also, he is going to consider, he's meant to consider all sides of the problem facing the world. And he does that. He goes to Irontown, hears out Lady Eboshi, meets the people there, doesn't shy away from any of that, you know, meets the Princess Mononoke, San, and the wolf gods, and Okoto, too. He doesn't sort of close his mind off from a side of the conflict that he's decided he doesn't like or he's against or he has some preconceived notions about. He hears everyone out. And then, I think this is crucial, he chooses a side. I do not think that the movie makes any bones about this. I don't think so. And when you said Ashitaka is a peacemaker, I think that you were correct. I do also think that people can kind of have the wrong idea about peacemakers and about empathy in general, and that it's supposed to be this sort of version of neutrality, right? But mm-hmm. Ashitaka actually is empathetic with everyone on all sides of this conflict, but he still chooses the forest. He chooses to side with the deer god and with preserving his life and with keeping the forest alive.
If I may just make an observation then based on what you've just said, like, this might be a new criticism of mine, or maybe just, again, call an observation, really. Because you are correct, Ashitaka does choose the forest, and make no bones about it, folks. Like, if you still haven't seen the film, firstly, get your fucking head checks. Secondly, he's unambiguously right on this.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, killing the forest spirit results in, well, God, how best to put this? It's like watching the Luna Cry from Final Fantasy VIII, except it's happening everywhere and it's also in 4K. Enjoy that nightmare fuel. So he is unambiguously correct in his assertion. And that's fine. I don't mind. I definitely do not mind him being like right on that point. But do you think it might actually harm the idea of him being like this moral decision maker that in the end he was so unambiguously right? Because if he can so clearly see that, shouldn't everyone else? Or in turn, does that then, you know, play into the point I made, which everyone is so blinded by hatred that they literally cannot recognize that killing this forest spirit will, well, it'll be the end of the world as we know it and we don't feel fine?
Well, I think you could say that, like, yeah, some of the characters are definitely blinded by hatred. But also, I think prior to Irontown getting blown up and San saving her, that Lady Eboshi, no matter what arguments you used, she would dig her heels in on her position and she would come at you with good reasons why she's doing the things that she's doing. I think, and that's what's so incredible, I think, about the conflict portrayed in this movie is that on the one hand, Ashitaka is unambiguously right. And he's picked a side, and that's the right side. But the people on the other side, the wrong side, they are wrong, but they still have what are to them good and sufficient reasons to be doing what they're doing. This is very, very hard, all of this shit. And I think just because you were doing the wrong thing doesn't mean that you don't have sort of activating and animating reasons to why that you would do that thing that aren't necessarily just based in hatred.
I've just had a kind of wicked thought, and you're going to hate me for doing this, but here's the thing though, right? I think that as much as I said before that Mononoke has become more relevant because of the climate change issue, I mean, it's unambiguously, you know, true in my eyes, at least, that climate change is a real thing and we need to kind of, you know, deal with it because, I mean, I don't know about you, Doc, but I don't particularly like the idea of living on our own, you know, homemade version of Venus, to be quite honest, if it ever gets that hot. So the reason I'm bringing this up, though, is that if, like, in the same vein that, you know, that Eboshi is so unambiguously wrong, like, does that not weaken the film somewhat, like, when we compare it to, like, or rather weaken its relevance somewhat, that we are willing to give her that nuance about her reasoning why, when the outcome is so clearly not in doubt that it's the end of everything?
It's the way things are in our own world. You know, we can sit here and feel like, okay, the science is on our side. We're totally right about climate change, or we're totally right about any issue. I don't know, like women's right to abortion or the existence of God, whatever. But like, that's a different thing. That's not a moral question. That's just a sort of scientific or religious question, but moral issues specifically and political ones. We could feel that way, but there are still people that will push back.
Oh, I agree that they will. I'm not saying that she shouldn't.
Yeah, I don't think the fact that there's a right answer in any way undercuts the points or the good things about this movie.
Oh, no. I'm thinking just more like it's just funny how times change your interpretation of it, because prior to the science becoming so understood as it was about climate change, Like, I would probably not have come to this realization, but like I say, you know, for all that we can sympathize with Eboshi's, like, you know, agenda of, like, saving the brothel workers, saving the lepers, and building a home for them, like, she is so unambiguously in the wrong to the point where it will be the end of everyone, you know, end of all life on Earth, that do those reasons even matter anymore? What reason could there possibly be? Now, I'll confess, as I've been saying this, as I will confess, I should probably point out, like, it's taken us a long time to come to an understanding of what climate change is. We've had plenty of tools to do that, you know, like computer simulations, actual studies, you name it, core samples from ice, blah-de-blah-de-blah-de-blah-de-blah. I could go on for hours about it. Eboshi, she's a soldier, and in diegetic terms, like, you know, she doesn't really know ahead of time that killing the forest spirit, I suppose, is going to be the end of everything. I suppose I should cut her some slack on that.
Oh, yeah, yeah. No, I think that's a really good point. Totally, yeah. She is definitely not aware that, like, there will be sort of a causal relationship between her shooting this deer and, you know, death of the planet.
Although, that being said, I don't think that maybe applies quite so much to Jikobo. Because he definitely knows.
He does. Yeah.
What?
You don't want to know something crazy? Like, and like, how do I thought about not bringing this up at all because it was so weird. But when talking about Jiko, like, Miyazaki said, oh, he's the Japanese person in this movie. What? What?
That's oh my god. That's, wow. That's certainly a statement.
It is quite a statement. But yeah, he basically is like, yeah, he's kind of an asshole when the rubber meets the road.
Yeah.
Oh god.
I mean, I'll just say, folks that listen at home, like, I'm going to just say that for all that I might, like, you know, be going back and forth on my various feelings about the film and how my understanding of it has changed over time relative to our modern world, because, I mean, you know, it's clearly, you know, something that has become more relevant. Like, I don't think any of us can deny that. The fact that I can derive such meaning from this, even, like, you know, that's forcing me to constantly challenge my own assertions about the film itself and my understanding of, like, morality. So I, like, what more of a, like, endorsement do you want for how rich the story is here?
Yeah.
That we can get such discussion out of this, like, where we can look at these characters. Like, I mean, we said that they were nuanced, and by God, I hope we've proved that. We've not even really discussed as much as we otherwise could do about Eboshi, for example.
I know. We'll get to it. Definitely, that's the last big item on my agenda, is Lady Eboshi. But just to close the loop on my moral decision-making model with Ashitaka. So, he chooses a side unambiguously, but he empathizes with both sides all the way through. You know, he could easily kill Lady Eboshi anytime he wanted to, and it would solve a lot of problems, but that is not in his moral calculus to do. It's not a thing that he would do at all. I mean, like, he told her, like, I would let my arm tear you apart if it would end all the hate, but it would just multiply it. So why would I do that? And he doesn't let his empathy for her, though, and Toki and Kuroko and the people he saves in Iron Town, blind him that there is a right choice. Like I said, I think people have this idea about empathy that it's sort of a mealy-mouthed or kind of neutral party thing, or that you're meant to say, well, no one's right and no one's wrong. Everyone is just...
the rights and freedoms of all sentient beings, blah, 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 right, blah, like, blah.
But, like, no. I mean, he thinks Lady Eboshi's straight up wrong. And he opposes her throughout the movie. He throws a knife into her gun. He stuns her by hitting her in the chest. Like, but he's trying to save her. He's trying to save her.
In fact, in the penultimate moment before, like, the forest god is slain, like, he breaks the gun then, as you say. But he could have killed her.
Yes.
Like, he tried to disarm her first and foremost before killing her, even though he had a pretty good idea at that point that if she did kill the forest spirit, then, well, we're going up the creek without the paddle, so to speak.
What a character, man. I love this guy. I love this character.
He is great.
But I've grown to love Lady Eboshi as well, even more. Not more than Ashitaka, but I guess I should sort of say, I've grown to love her more and more each time I watch the movie. But sorry, you go ahead. You finish about Ashitaka. I didn't.
No, carry on. I was always just really going to say something in affirmation, to be honest.
Yeah, I mean, it's just interesting, right? That, like, you know, you were talking about her being so unambiguously wrong. I don't know if there's a way that she could even see that before everything that happened at the end happened. Like, does it strike you that, like, if, like, San and Eboshi sat down for tea together, like, they would come to some kind of middle ground?
No.
Like, they both want to destroy each other's home.
No. I think that San, in that particular dinner scene, like, if that was happening, she'd probably be stabbing the table repeatedly in that kind of way you play with your hand. You know, do. Just because she's trying to, like, distract herself from actually stabbing Eboshi in the face.
Yes.
So... No, I don't think that was possible. And the thing is, like, I think, again, that's why Ashitaka serves the outside purpose that he does, because you can't, like, beat hate with hate, so to speak, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You're only going to end up, like, perpetuating and feeding off of each other, like, you know. But there's a saying that I'm very fond of, which is that there's a problem with the old adage of eye for an eye, which is that everyone ends up blind. And I think that maybe in turn is why, as much as I say that it is kind of like chilling to think that, well, it would take an outside force to make them get out of their funk and stop trying to murder each other. Maybe that's the pragmatic and honest truth of it, that sometimes we can become so caught in that quagmire and that cycle of like vengeance and violence that it does take a third party to like play peacemaker. Indeed, that's happened a lot of times through the past. Like, I mean, I think Kennedy, for example, was influential in getting the Good Friday Agreement created for Northern Ireland following the Troubles. Mm-hmm. Now, just before any history buffs come in and start like kicking down my front door and throwing things at me, that's my very, very basic like from memory knowledge of it. And it's probably a lot more nuanced than that. Maybe Kennedy did not have such a strong involvement. But nonetheless, I can certainly point to instances in the past where that's been the case.
Yeah, and that does make sense to me, just someone who hasn't been poisoned, you know, by the cycle already. And about Eboshi, I think, so Jiko is like a bad faith actor in this movie, but Eboshi is not. Like, she's a good faith actor. And that is why I just adore, like, I can't think of anything, like, new to say, I don't think, that we've already said, except that I don't like her hat. Her hat is the only thing I dislike about her. But, like, she's just, like, has her own reasons that, like, make sense to her and that are, on their own, divorced from the solution. Like, they're really good things. Mm. And I think she's, like, a really admirable woman in a lot of ways.
She's hubris, basically. Like, good old hubris. I've got good intentions, but I'm just going about them in the wrong way. And that's why we can't ultimately really hate her for what she's done, even though some of the stuff she's done is quite awful, like what she did with the Boar God, for example.
Yeah, Nago, yeah.
Nago, where she deliberately poisoned him with that bullet rather than just killing him. I mean, that sends a statement, certainly, don't get me wrong, but it's also incredibly cruel on her part. So... again, I suppose the argument is always, hey, best of intentions, be careful, take a step back, don't go too far. I'm going to make one final point, which is going to be about San herself.
Okay.
So, what I really appreciate about San's presence in the film, just on its own, just by her merely existing, is that she serves as a bridge in her own right to show that, for all that, you know, we humans, such as Eboshi, have got this, like, you know, quagmire of hatred, that the gods are no better. Now, someone who, like her, is objectively not a wolf, but was raised like one. I think it speaks to, like, how it's not what you're born with. Like, you know, you're not born to hate something, but rather you're raised that point. And indeed, there's kind of a contradiction in her existing as she does at all, because on the one hand, the wolves hate the humans. They hate the fuck out of them. But they still saved her and raised her. Which, you know, arguably doesn't make sense, but, you know, we're not, even the gods in this film are not necessarily logical beings.
No.
And I think it speaks against the hope that even is present before, like, all the other stuff happens. That, hey, you know what, like, they still spared her. They still recognized she was an innocent. Granted, they then passed on that same ideology of, you know, destroy all humans to her, which is not a good thing by any measure of the mean. Any means of the measure, sorry, I mean to say. But they still took a step further as opposed to doing what they probably would have done otherwise, which was, well, chicken nugget.
A true nugget, yeah.
Yeah, so her existence alone in the film, like even before she says a single line of dialogue, is again a fine example of the layers that are built up onto this conflict and how there are shades to the characters that suggest that even though they are currently, you know, going through the motions of just killing each other, we fight back, we get hit, we fight back, blah, 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 blah. Like, long-standing gang violence, really, more than anything else. That the door has always been open for them to leave, and indeed they've kind of looked out the window at that once or twice.
Mm.
But they just need to go a bit further, and they need a push to do it, which is where Ashitaka comes in.
Yeah, San is actually involved in my... It's really hard to pick a favorite scene. And I'll ask you about yours in just a sec, but I think this one is definitely a contender, if not the winner.
Mine is definitely the ending, but...
Okay.
But there are still plenty of other ones. But anyway, lay out yours. Go on.
Mine is when Ashitaka has had his curse lifted by the forest spirit, and San is visiting him, telling him about Yakul and how they had a talk. And Ashitaka is depleted of strength. You know, he's been shot through the stomach and was only spared by the deer god, and he still can't move, and he needs to be nursed back to health, and San gives him some food to eat, and he can't even eat it, and she's like, chew, and he tries to chew, but his mouth muscles are so weak, it just falls out of his mouth, and she chews the food for him.
Wow.
And puts it in his mouth, and then she looks over at him after tearing off some more, after doing it two or three times, and he's crying, like, and the music has completely faded out. It's just silence, and you're sort of just surrounded by, like, the quiet beauty of this grove, this pool of the deer god, and the purity of it, the sanctity of it, and it's amazing. It, like, moves my heart every single time. It's so beautiful.
Yeah. There are, like, for all that we've said that this film can be quite dark in places, there's still plenty of light in it. And plenty of, like, moments of levity, like back in, the, you know, the village with that lady voiced by Jada Pinkett Smith.
Now I've forgotten her name.
I've forgotten it too. Because I'm a very bad anime critic. I'm so sorry.
Yeah, me too. Toki, yeah. Mm. Great moments with her. And just ragging the hell out of Kuroku. I wish the wolves had eaten you. useless. You won't be able to work with a broken arm. And I love that Ashitaka is like, I was starting to think I had done something wrong by bringing him back alive. It's amazing.
Well, you know how it is. You're just there, you're trying to raise your daughter into a wholesome, respectable individual. She just brings this random boy back one time, doesn't even give you any advance warning of it, and you wake, you know, you find him on the couch, and he's completely and utterly, like, you know, shit-faced, and he's rolling over and all that. It's like, I didn't raise you to be this way. I'm saying that San might be a little rebellious. Not that there aren't any hints of that in the film.
No. But yeah, this movie makes me laugh. It, you know, moves me to tear up with the scene I talked about. It has, like, the mystery and the beauty of nature, so much, but also horror and grotesque scenes and brutal violence. A lot of blood is vomited up, but also, like, stirring monologues and, like, compelling characters and amazing scenery. To me, like, yeah, I could just watch this movie over and over, Shadon. Like,
yeah.
All these elements I love, and, like, there's never, like, in so many, almost any anime, movie, or TV series, there's always, like, in my brain, I don't want to admit it out loud, but always in my brain, it's like, oh, this part. This is the part I'm not as into. This is sort of a slow part. But this movie, just, I never have that. Every single scene is a scene that I really, really, really like.
I agree. I think I'll close out my thoughts on the film by bringing it back to what I said at the very beginning, which is just to speak to my own experience here of when I saw it, which was I saw it firstly in a public place under that kind of atmosphere where people were talking openly about it, making the mega comment, you know, everyone's having a couple of drinks while they're doing it. And that's not to say that like people weren't engaged with the film, far from it, but they were engaged for it for like its wondrous beauty, like, you know, and this thing that Ghibli has of a reverence for nature that doesn't go so far as to like almost become like cult, like, you know, we must go back to the earth kind of thing. Like the idea of Iron Town, like, for example, as I say, is not a bad one, and the film doesn't present it as such. It's just its execution that's the problem. But nonetheless, people were enjoying it on that kind of level where it's more towards the surface appreciation of it as a work of art in the sense of like its artistic qualities. Watching it on my own in the comfort of my own home, you know, with my headphones on, letting me soak in the words, soaking in my own time, I came to appreciate so much more the second time around for its actual substance. I mean, I suppose one might argue that it's trite and passé to just simply throw in yet another, like, you know, don't destroy nature message, as Ghibli often like do in their films. But again, that's missing, ironically, the forest for the trees on how, like, there is that level of detail on the character motivations and the reasons why they're all doing it. And the fact that these somehow coexist with the fact that, reasons be damned, people can still, you know, be blinded by rage and, you know, vitriol for others and other groups, which is something we need to overcome. I mean, I hope, like, I mean, I probably not even covered, like, a fifth of, like, the things you could take away from this film.
But, oh, my God.
But I'm sure that at least I hope I've impressed on you that there is a lot of depth to it. Like, for all that I think that people might want to look at Ghibli sometimes like as this thing from Japan that actually reaches a level of high art, like, and from, you know, looking at it in trailers and such like that, like, there is a genuine heart to it. And what's more, it's not like, you know, the same necessarily as Laputa or Kaguya. Like, they all have their own messages to bring and they're all delivered in the same. Think of it like we said with Gaiman. Like, Gaiman's got a lot of done a lot of stories, and he has his own very distinct style of doing it. But his stories always have something to say. And in Ghibli's case, like, for all that they have this style of theirs, you know, this very like art house kind of thing, this incredible level of detail, the hard work they put into everything, you know, they still really do make very human films, and it's just a joy to watch them every single time for that reason.
Yeah, I love what you said there about high art, but with a heart, you know, not abstract, something that you could sink your teeth into it, and you could feel really strongly about it, and it will, you know, it's the kind of thing that there's depth there, and you could, like you said, work to mine all that out, but it will also, this movie will meet you where you are in a lot of ways, I think.
I would agree.
Anything more to talk about this wonderful? I think there's more we could say, but I think maybe we broadly covered all the topics we wanted to touch on.
Yeah, I've certainly said my piece on it. Just to reiterate, like, the stuff I said before that I was a bit more negative on, like, in the grand scheme of things, that's all, like, minor thing, like, stuff. Like, niggly little details. That's just more my own, like, viewpoint. Don't take anything that I've said in the negative, or indeed even the positive for that matter, as gospel. My overall opinion on the film, though, is much like, you know, I came away from the first time I watched it very positive, and I came away from it even more positive the second time around. Who knows, if I watch it again a third time, maybe I'll like it even more, and maybe the complaints I originally had that I've mentioned in this podcast will disappear, and I'll look back on my younger self, and I'll think, God, he was a fucking moron, wasn't he?
That's how our lives generally are about most things.
Ringing endorsement from me on Mononoke. What a great surprise, honestly.
I've watched it, like I said, a bunch of times, and certainly the initial few watches, I was like, this is really good. Oh, man, this is really, oh, my God, this is an all-time favorite. Like, each time, just liked it more and more, and it's still, like, a fresh experience for me. I keep either being struck anew by things or kind of appreciating things from a different angle or getting just whole new things out of it. Like, yeah, there's a lot to this movie. You should definitely see it. I think it is, I haven't seen as much 90s J- Ghibli as some, or as much 80s, certainly, or sorry, as much as I have seen 80s Ghibli, because there's less of it. But of the Ghibli that I have seen of the 90s, this is my favorite. And easily my favorite. And one of my favorite anime films, one of my favorite films, period, of all time. I love this movie. Please watch it.
It to me, like, of the three we've watched thus far, Lapsa is still my personal favorite. But I think that, again, it speaks to the quality of Ghibli's works that, like, for all I can say that this is, like, a second or a third versus Kaguya and Lapsa, they're all great in their own way because they've all got their own identity and their own things to say. It's a blessing to have, like, a rich library of work from a studio like this where, you know, for all that we can say that they have that, like, sensibility about them that you can identify them as a Ghibli film, that they all have their own flavors to them.
Mm-hmm.
So for all that I might say, well, I like Lapsa more, don't take that to mean this film is bad. Quite the opposite. It's a crowded, like, place, you know, that these films exist in terms of quality. It's almost going to, like, break out into a fight, methinks, you know. To wrestle for the top spot.
It's like choosing children. That you
No, yeah. So, like, man, the Sophie's Choice, right? In Ghibli's Choice, even in terms of picking it, which one's best. It's true.
Yeah, I think that we are done talking about Princess Mononoke for now.
For now.
And we're done with the Christmas Ghiblis for now.
Oh, wow, yeah. But we'll be... I think we can say we'll be back next year.
Oh, well, unquestionably. Look, I really enjoyed doing, like, this has been some of the most rewarding podcasting I've done ever. So I'm definitely up for the Ghibli project next year. But we'll certainly, whether we do Ghibli or not, we'll do something for the holidays. We always do. But for this holiday, 2019's Christmas, Hanukkah, Kwanzaa, Mega Christmas.
Lost Christmas, don't forget that.
Lost Christmas, Festivus.
So sorry.
All of the above. I hope that everyone out there is having an incredible time, a safe time, whether you're by yourself or with family, with friends. I hope that you are content. I hope that you are warm. And I hope that you are happy. And I hope that this podcast series has been able to bring some extra warmth and happiness into your holiday time, or any time if you're listening to this later on. Honestly, these are pretty evergreen.
Damn straight. I could not put it better myself. And one final thing I'll add is that to firstly thank all of our lovely patrons for helping support us to make projects like this possible. It is very humbling and an honor to have people be willing to finance us in such a way to cover this. It's actually genuinely still kind of takes my breath away when I think about it, that people would do that.
Yeah.
So thank you so much from the bottom of my heart for doing that.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll continue to do our best to, you know, return your investment with good content. And secondly, just in general, even if you're not a patron, thank you, the listener, for taking the time out of your day to listen to us talk about this film, or indeed if you've listened to any of our other podcasts. Like, it's really, really appreciated. All I would ask in turn, if you've got the time, is just to drop us a like or a subscribe on wherever you may find this, just to help our discoverability. If you've got any thoughts or comments, you're more than welcome to send to us on that service, or indeed via Twitter at Waridesho. If you want to become a patron to get early access, do check us out, patreon.com/Waridesho. But yeah, we do this for you guys and girls and non-binary pals, you know, everyone and everyone in between. And I'm glad that hopefully you've all enjoyed it, and we will continue to keep doing it. As long as people want to hear it, we'll keep doing it. So again, from the bottom of my heart, thank you all so very much. Happy Christmas, happy holidays, happy whatever you plan to do. Make the best of it. I can attest personally that I do find Christmas difficult. There's no way of pointing that out. But you know what? Like, if there's anything that these films have taught me, particularly Kaguya, given the light of what you said on it, Doc, is that make the best of it. It might still be a bit rubbish, to be honest, but there's no harm in trying to make a good time for yourself. Mm. I hope that for people who are struggling at Christmas, who maybe listen to this, that you do find that.
Hear, hear. And with that said, happy holidays, happy new year, and embrace each other, everyone, to the ends of the universe.
Good night.